And welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Musk-Hawain. America's children are experiencing a mental health crisis, and the COVID-19 pandemic has made a bad situation worse. That's the bottom line of a new study from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Mental health issues among young people were on the rise before COVID. Now, a new CDC report says more than a third of high school students reported mental health problems in 2021, and nearly half said they felt persistently sad or hopeless during the past year. On top of that, more than half reported emotional abuse by a parent or other adult, and about a third said that a parent or other adult in the home had lost a job. The numbers were even worse for female and LGBTQ students in every area, from depression to emotional abuse to attempted suicide. So this hour on Radio Times, a conversation about what's going on and how to help children in crisis. But we begin with a closer look at the CDC study by Kathleen Ethier, director of the CDC's Division of Adolescent and School Health. Dr. Ethier, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi, Tracy. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. And as we've noted, mental health issues among young people were on the rise before COVID. And now we're seeing, according to the CDC report, over a third reporting worsening mental health, nearly half saying that they felt persistently sad or hopeless over the last year. How big a jump is that over pre-COVID levels?
Well, we can't really compare to prior data since the methodology of this study was somewhat different. But I will say it is an important view into where young people are now. We were seeing increases in all of the outcomes that you mentioned prior to the pandemic. I think what we now see in this data, which is incredibly important, because although we expected and heard some of the findings anecdotally, and we were seeing these increases in poor mental health prior to the pandemic, what this data does is it really provides us the evidence to say with certainty that the pandemic was incredibly disruptive for young people. But although all students were impacted, not all students were impacted equally. And so we saw some real disparities both in the experiences that young people had as well as the mental health and suicide implications of those experiences.
Yeah, and I want to dive into those disparities in just a moment, but I'm curious, how many young people were surveyed and how does the CDC gather this kind of data?
So we have been conducting what's known as the Youth Risk Behavior Survey or surveillance system for about 30 years. And we used a very similar way of collecting the data. So we contacted a nationally representative set of high schools around the country who then recruited students in those high schools. So the difference between what we normally do and this survey was that the students were able to fill the survey out online. Normally they do it in a classroom setting. And what that allowed us to do was to survey students who were both attending school in person and those who were attending virtually. And so we surveyed in this survey about 8,000 youth across the country. The sample is nationally representative. And I think so it really lets us know that these data are really kind of telling us what's happening with the young people in the country.
Yeah. And Kathleen, do you think it's possible that some of this owes to the fact that young people now seem to hold less of a stigma around mental health issues and maybe just more comfortable in reporting their own experiences than perhaps their parents or grandparents might be?
I think that may be part of it from a generational standpoint. I don't think that can fully explain why in the 10 years prior to this survey we saw that kind of increase. I don't think that would fully explain what we had been seeing in the data already. I think it also doesn't account for what we see in terms of suicidal thoughts and behaviors and suicide attempts. And I think that paired with what young people are telling us about their feelings is really a cause for concern. What we're hearing from youth is that a significant portion of them don't want to live and think about committing suicide. Whether or not that translates into actual suicide rates, it still is a really significant indicator of kind of where young people are right now.
That's quite alarming. And the CDC report says that for females and LGBTQ kids, that the numbers are even worse. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think anytime you are, you know, kind of part of a stigmatized group, I think the impact on mental health is significant. We also found that students who experienced racism in school were also more likely to have poor mental health and to consider suicide. So I think what we're seeing among the LGBTQ kids is exactly that. They are experiencing kind of toxic environments. They are experiencing stigma, and it translates into poor mental health. I think why we see this particularly in girls is a little bit more of a puzzle, and I think something we have to dig a little deeper into. I think certainly some of the studies we've seen on social media suggest that it has a more negative impact on young women. I think young women are also subjected to sexual violence in ways that their male counterparts are not. And we know that experience of violence contributes to poor mental health and suicidal thoughts and behaviors. So I think that picture, we need to really dig some more into what's happening with our young women. I think it's it is of real concern that we are seeing this gender-based difference, and something that we really need to figure out what to do about.
I also want to drill down for a moment on racism, because you mentioned that a moment ago, and the CDC study said that the numbers were particularly high among Asian students and also among African American and some other groups. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because certainly we heard about the vitriol that was directed at Asian Americans, particularly earlier in the pandemic.
Yeah, this is the first time that we have nationally representative data on young people's experiences of racism in school and the impact on the mental health of youth of color. So it's difficult, it's actually impossible to know whether the elevated rates we see among Asian students is directly related to anything to do with the pandemic and potential stigma related to the pandemic. So we don't really know that, because we weren't asking the question prior to. I think what this tells us, however, is that we need to make every effort to make sure that youth of color are not experiencing racism in school. I think what we see here is, regardless of whether it has increased or what the cause is, that school environment is incredibly important. And so making sure that we are protecting students of color becomes really essential. When we see data like this, it really kind of shows the impact of that experience on those youth. I think, you know, at the same time, the other thing that this data points to, in a really positive way, we see that feeling connected to people at school, feeling that people at school care about you, are in your success, what we call school connectedness, was a really important factor in mitigating the impact of the pandemic on youth mental health. So young people who felt connected to others at their school had better mental health outcomes. Unfortunately, what we also see is that for young people who experience racism in school, they feel less connected. And so that protective factor that has really long-term implications for a whole variety of outcomes for youth into adulthood then becomes unavailable to youth who experience racism in school. So I think it adds to the need to really make sure that our schools are safe and supportive for all students, particularly those who are most vulnerable.
Yeah, so it sounds like school can be, for many students, a safe haven, but for some students, it can actually exacerbate some issues. And I'm just thinking, too, about the length of time that students spent at home, particularly earlier in the pandemic, and how the CDC report mentioned emotional abuse at home, that more than half of the students surveyed reported experiencing emotional abuse. Can you talk about what exactly that is, what constitutes emotional abuse, and what you think is behind that increase?
I mean, I think it is very, very clear that families were under stress. Earlier studies that we did earlier in the pandemic really pointed to the issues around parental job loss, around food insecurity, around housing insecurity, and how all of those issues were really stressing families out. The question that we asked about emotional abuse During the COVID-19 pandemic, how often did a parent or other adult in your home swear at you, insult you, or put you down? And I think those behaviors coming from parents or other adults in the home just point to just how stressed out families were during the pandemic. For some young people, that will reverse. And as families become less stressed, there's a opportunity for recovery. Because we haven't asked that question before, we don't know kind of how persistent a problem this is. But I would also say that family connectedness, similar to school connectedness, is also an incredibly important protective factor. And so I think while we did hear some reports that being able to be home and be within a supportive family environment was, you know, a real benefit of everyone being home together, I think the stress that families were experiencing really had a negative impact for a significant portion of young people.
And we know certainly that everyone was affected in one way or another. The pandemic created stress for all of us. But why has it had such a pronounced effect on young people in particular?
I think in this developmental period that we're talking about, these were all high school students, the isolation from friends, from activities at school, from important adults in school, really led to a level of social isolation that was really impactful for this age group. We didn't, you know, we don't have data from children, and we don't have data from adults in quite the same way. So it's hard to say whether or not they were more severely impacted. But I think if you think about this time of life and the importance of kind of your social structure, having that taken away can lead to incredible isolation. And I think that's what we're seeing in this data. I think also kind of coming back to the protective nature of school connectedness lets us know that when that's withdrawn, you know, the reverse is also true. So lack of that connectedness is detrimental. So while school connectedness can be a really positive mitigating force, losing that when you've had it can really be that detrimental.
So, Kathleen, I've got 30 seconds before we have to say goodbye and I have to take a break, but I do want to ask you in the last 30 seconds, what's the most important thing that adults can do in the lives of young people to help them get through this and stabilize their mental health on the other side?
I think for us, two things are incredibly important. One is to make sure that our schools are safe and supportive for all students, that they are inclusive, that they don't promote racism, that the environment, school environments are not toxic for young people. I think that is, young people spend an incredible amount of time in school. Making sure that those environments are safe and supportive is incredibly important. And then I think the next thing is, whether it's families or schools, making sure that young people have access to the services that they need.
Kathleen, I'm going to stop you right there because I've got to take a break. But Kathleen Ethier from the CDC, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscow-Wayne. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the current mental health crisis among children and teens. A new CDC report confirms what many knew experientially, which is that the COVID-19 pandemic has only made matters worse. But even before COVID, mental health challenges were the leading cause of disability and poor life outcomes among young people, according to the Surgeon General. Since COVID, there has been a significant rise in mental health-related emergency room visits and a huge backlog of cases for mental health professionals. So how did we get here, and what will it take to help children and teens heal and move forward with mental health intact? For that, we turn to a pair of experts. Dr. Rhonda Boyd is a psychologist in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Rhonda, welcome to you. And Dr. Emily Becker-Hames is assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and the clinical director of the Pediatric Anxiety Treatment Center at Hall Mercer, also known as the PATCH program. Dr. Hames, welcome to you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Rhonda, let me begin with you. You have done a great deal of work in the area of teen depression, and I'm curious about whether you were surprised at all by the CDC report that said that more than a third of high school students reported worsening mental health. Nearly half reported persistent feelings of sadness and hopelessness. Any surprise to you?
I was not surprised. Unfortunately, I was not. Depression has been increasing over years, and it's been under-recognized, I believe, being able to sort of identify children who have depression. So teens, and I typically see teenagers here in Philadelphia, mostly girls, and most of them are Black or African American. And so I've been seeing it get more, even more severe, the depression that these youth are experiencing in my time of practicing. And so we also see a lot of kids who come in with depression also have suicidal thoughts, behaviors, and that we spend a lot of our clinical time trying to keep them safe and working on the depression. So, and I understand how COVID has made things even more challenging because these kids are more isolated. So when you think you had depression, and now you're isolated, and some of the things that we used to work on in therapy, behavior activation is something that we use. We try to get people more active. So when you're depressed, you may lay in bed, sad, isolate. Most of the time, we're like, go out, do things, you work on that. When COVID hit, all that was taken away from us. But it was hard to kind of try to make therapy different. How do you get out when things are dangerous? And so these kids were stuck in the house. Their school changed. They didn't have these outlets that we used to promote.
Yeah. And I'm curious, in addition to the suicidal thoughts, how has the depression tended to express itself in the young people that you work with? And is there a difference between girls and boys? I know you said you see mostly girls, but what does it look like?
So one of the things about depression is that it looks slightly different in people, and I think that's some of the reasons why it may be missed. There's a constellation of about 9 symptoms. One of the things for children and teens, having depressed sadness, but you can also be irritable. And I think the irritability is the thing that kids exhibit that is often viewed differently for other people. So I hear people think they put it more in like externalizing behaviors because someone may get irritable, they may snap at people. But for youth, that it constitutes depression. Also, is not much interest in activities. So sometimes kids may stop doing activities they used to. Someone may not recognize. They may say, oh, I'm not interested in that anymore. And people don't realize that they've lost interest in it. Then you see appetite disturbance. So it could be increased or decreased. Also, there's sleep disturbance. And teen sleep is already, you know, many times off, they may sleep too much or less. And so those things, and sometimes parents don't know how much their kids are sleeping. And so they also may be agitated or move slow, feel worthless, have difficulty concentrating. And so it looks slightly different in all the different kids. And so that may be sometimes, I think there's certain symptoms that people may attribute to something else than not depression.
Good thing for parents and teachers to be looking out for. Before we move forward, let me just invite our listeners to join us in the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. You can always pick up the phone and call us too at 888-477-9499. Emily Becker Hames, you see a lot of young people who are struggling with anxiety, among other issues. What have you seen in your young patients over the course of the pandemic as it relates to anxiety?
Absolutely. I think what we see really resonates with what Kathleen was sharing about the CDC report, just an absolute explosion of anxiety amongst kids and teenagers. I'll say, you know, referrals for mental health services is just mind-blowingly high. We see the demand has gone up, I think, probably at least 400%. You know, we used to get a couple of referrals a month at sort of peak times of difficulty. We were getting up to 6 referrals in a day. Just extreme demand for services. And I think to what Rhonda was sharing, right, a lot of the resources and strategies we would use to help kids get better were no longer available to us, right? Which means kids weren't graduating from therapy, which means there weren't new slots for kids who are newly struggling to get in. So there's this whole cascaded effect across our system that has really not been suiting our teenagers well.
Yeah. And it raises the issue of the lack of mental health professionals, or just the shortage, I should say, of mental health professionals. I mean, how do you manage that kind of demand?
We do our best. I think we work within a system, and I think everybody, nobody has an ego or stake. Everybody just wants kids to get well, right? So it's, you know, if we want to refer you, and I encourage families to call every place within their network, get on every wait list that you can, and take the first available appointment. Like, no ego, just go where you can get. And then we try to obviously increase our capacity and keep that referral and wait list time as short as it can possibly be. But we are working with a real shortage, as you said, of trained and professional mental health workers, which makes it very, very challenging.
And it sounds like parents really have to be resourceful in terms of trying to find help wherever they can find it, even if maybe it's not the ideal source or the source that they would have gone to, but to just kind of get some help somewhere.
I think, unfortunately, that is the state of the mental health service landscape right now. Yeah.
And also, as it relates to anxiety, what are you seeing, and how does it manifest in the young people that you work with?
Yeah, so anxiety can look, just as Rhonda was saying about depression, it can look really different depending on the individual child. Some of the key features, though, that cut across different ways anxiety can manifest really relate to what we call maladaptive avoidance, or not wanting to engage with the things that make us feel stressed or scared, right? So anxiety is a core human emotion. It's there. We all need it. It keeps us safe from harm. It motivates us to stay healthy and succeed. But when it gets to be too high, when that alarm signal gets overly sensitive, it starts to go off too much. And oftentimes we then sort of withdraw and start avoiding the things that cause us stress. And so that's one of the main hallmark features that we're looking for when people are thinking about whether anxiety has reached a point that it might warrant treatment, is that avoidance at a place where it's really pervasive across different domains, where it's causing really clear distress and impairment, and has been persisting for a period of time where it's no longer typical of the normal waxes and wanes of the normal amount of anxiety we all might experience.
Yeah. So I imagine then that looks like maybe you don't want to leave the house, you don't want to go certain places, you don't want to engage in certain activities because it's just because you're afraid of how it's going to make you feel.
Absolutely, right? Not wanting to go out where there might be other people, even if it's in a masked setting where the risks of COVID are relatively low, but the idea of talking to someone, even over a screen, becomes scary and aversive, or not wanting to go certain places, not to leave the house, just as you said.
Yeah. And Rhonda, I want to come back to something that we talked about with Kathleen from the CDC just a few minutes ago, and that is that the study that the CDC did revealed that more than half of the students surveyed reported emotional abuse, and we talked about that a little bit. But I'm curious, as someone who is in the trenches with young people, what all of that tells us about the stress that families are experiencing and how adults have been coping or not coping with the stresses that they've been under since COVID, and how that sort of has a secondhand smoke effect then on children.
Yes, I think families have been under a lot of stress. And so I do think there also is evidence, and the CDC printed out something several months ago showing that caregivers, parents actually were exhibiting high levels of both adverse mental health outcomes is how they termed it. Mm-hmm. And they also actually showed that they also had high numbers of thoughts of suicide themselves. And so when parents are under a lot of stress, it impacts their parenting. It impacts their ability to have patience with their child. And then they had more, there were financial stressors in the house. And also kids were at home being schooled. So parents became teachers, parents, the whole school personnel, as well as dealing with their own sort of isolation, losing their supports also. So we were and many times there was multiple generations in the house. So it may not just been a parent. It could be an uncle could have been in a house, aunt. It could be grandparents. So that question asks about other adults. So families sometimes had to come together, especially if there was economic stressors. And so I think we're seeing that, and we're still seeing these stresses on families.
Yeah. And of course, we know, Rhonda, that the COVID-19 virus hit communities of color especially hard. Is that also true in your experience of the mental health fallout from the COVID pandemic? In other words, are communities of color disproportionately affected in terms of mental health as well?
So suicide rates among Black youth has been increasing over the number of years. Indigenous Native American youth always have very high levels of suicide. And for Asian youth, it seems like that there has been some increase. And there's, so things have been trending up. So these stressors on the family, it's not clear if, you know, like sort of the depression rates are higher. I think one group that we don't talk about that came out in report is these multiracial youth. Oftentimes they're not looked at. They show that they are having high levels of depression and suicidal thoughts. And there's been some evidence earlier, but often we don't look at these youth. And that's a group that's underreported. There's a lot of trauma is, I think, one of the biggest things that we haven't really talked about. I mean, when you think about how COVID has impacted the loss that happened into communities of color, the grief, and in places like these major cities, we've been seeing high rates of violence that are going on. These kids are being exposed to a lot of things, losing family members, the violence that they may be nearby in their neighborhoods. And then we talk about they're experiencing racism. We spent a period of, they've watched a lot of videos of people getting killed.
George Floyd happened during the pandemic.
And they watch them over and over again. Actually, there's evidence to show watching those videos increase depression and post-traumatic stress symptoms for teenagers. Yeah. And so I spent a lot of time in therapy talking about these cases, talking about it with kids, what they've experienced, how to handle it. Sometimes it wasn't talked about in the family. I would prefer families to talk about these issues, and not that I'm the only one talking about their with children about it, but I had to because it was impacting their mental health, everything that was going on. And so kids are constantly exposed to a lot of stress, kids of color. And I think we don't really talk about the stresses and the trauma that they go through and how that affects their mental health.
I want to talk a little bit more about the suicide numbers, because that is of particular concern. And Emily Becker-Hames, I'll direct this to you. I saw a staggering number in the Surgeon General's report that said that there was a 51% uptick in suspected suicide attempts among teen girls when we were kind of at the height of lockdown. It was something like 4% for boys. That sounds, I mean, you have to read that twice when you see it. What did you make of that?
I think, unfortunately, it parallels what we're seeing in clinical practice, where absolutely suicide rates, kids are presenting with higher levels of suicidality than I think, at least I was typically used to seeing in our practices for the period before COVID. And there's a lot less, I think, for all the reasons we talked about, the sort of social safety nets, the support networks, the community supports that really served as those protective buffers were no longer available. Yeah. And I'm very grateful for things like the National Suicide Prevention Hotlines and other resources that teenagers, fortunately, many times feel very comfortable reaching out to, as long as they know that it exists and they have a potentially trusted adult or even trusted friend who can give them those resources.
I was also struck, Emily, by the rise in suicidal ideation or self-injury in kids ages 5 to 17. And the 5 is what caught my attention. Talk about that.
So we certainly have known for a long time that suicidal ideation can present in young children, and to some extent, and I'm sure Rhonda can weigh in on this as well, like we are doing, I think, as a field, a better job of asking those questions more routinely among kids to be able to detect. So we may also be seeing more because of that, because we're doing a better job surveilling and asking those questions. But certainly it's a concern, and it means that we need to really be investing in our mental health supports, training teachers, training pediatricians, training people to feel comfortable asking and responding to kids who are sharing that, yes, I have thought about death. Yes, I have gone to bed and wished that maybe I wouldn't wake up tomorrow, and to have somebody not freak out and be a supportive listening ear and say, tell me what's going on for you. And then working to try to get them help is critical.
And starting as early as preschool, probably in kindergarten, it sounds like.
I think, you know, I think the jury's out a little bit on whether everyone needs to be screened as young as preschool, but certainly knowing that it can be there is important for everyone who's in a potentially what we call like a gatekeeping role, right? Who may encounter somebody is important for them to know that it can happen.
And just before we go to break, Rhonda, one last point on this, and that is that you mentioned that Black children are more likely to die by suicide. And I saw a number, and I think it was in the Surgeon General's report, that said that Black children are nearly twice as likely to die by suicide. Is that right? And can you talk a little bit more about that?
So the data you're talking about was a special age group. It was that younger age group, the 5 to 11, that a study came out a couple years ago. And that's when we first recognized that there was this disparity happening. And it was for that younger age group compared to white youth that the Black youth were more likely to die by suicide. And then during adolescence, this is not twice. It comes together. But that was that study actually opened my eyes because we did not know as a field that the rates were that high, especially deaf among these young children. And I typically see teens. And so we've been spending a lot more effort has been going to trying to figure out what is happening with Black youth because they have always been considered low risk for suicide, the Black community in general, and we know that is not the case anymore.
Yeah, it's certainly a wake-up call. We have so much more to talk about here on Radio Times, including, the causes behind this uptick in mental health issues in young people, but also what the adults in young people's lives can do to help mitigate things and help get our young people back on the right track. We welcome your comments and questions, and we've got a few listener comments when Radio Times comes right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about a recently released CDC report that said that there has been quite an uptick in mental health issues, particularly among young people, that something like a third reported worsening mental health conditions during COVID, something like half reported persistent feelings of sadness and hopelessness. And so we have been talking about how we got here, and we'll be talking about how we can find our way and help young people find their way through all of this. We've been talking with a pair of experts. Emily Becker-Hames is with us. She is assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine and the clinical director of the Pediatric Anxiety Treatment Center at Hall Mercer. Also with us is Dr. Rhonda Boyd, who is a psychologist in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. We invite you to add your voice to the conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or call 888-477-9499. And we do have a couple of listener comments that I'd like us to begin with. There is one from Facebook from Tom, who says, good to hear these issues are coming to the surface. Are schools bringing in mental health professionals to assist these children? So I would direct that to either one of you. Emily?
I can start. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So absolutely. There's been a big move actually for a number of years now, not only for schools, but to bring in mental health professionals to the places where kids are already, right? So primary care offices, school settings. And there is a, within the schools, there are a number of different level of increasing levels of support, beginning from just sort of screening and trying to catch kids who may be struggling, doing more universal interventions, right? Fostering an environment that really creates that school connectedness that we know can be a protective factor for kids, and then trying to catch the kids who need more individual one-on-one support and really train clinicians to give them brief interventions in the school setting. And then when kids need more support, trying to connect them with an outside provider. I'll say one thing that's been an advantage of the COVID has been this increased access to telehealth. And we have schools that are now also allowing kids to conduct telehealth sessions from their school so that they can meet with their therapists without needing to leave the school or miss like a full day or half day of school. And it really helps with continuity of services and supports access to care.
Yeah. Also, Gloria asks, how does social media contribute to this increased stress and what can be done to address it? So, Rhonda, talk about that, because social media seems to play a role in just about everything. How has it perhaps contributed to what we've been seeing?
So, you know, there's been a lot of discussion and results looking at studies trying to figure out how social media has impacted youth. I think part of it is it's been... Some studies showed it's been linked to, like, loneliness. For the teens that I see, I think part of it is a balance in some ways. During the pandemic, social media actually was a way to connect with the peers. And for some youth, especially youth that are marginalized and who don't have their group, social media is a way in which they may find their group. And so I've come to kind of change my views of recognizing the positive. One of the problems is they cannot spend all day on social media. And also, particularly that I've noticed with some of the teenage girls, they get really involved in sort of believing what they see on social media. And I think part of this is a developmental issue. Their brains are still developing. They may believe that people have perfect lives. And so I try to help them recognize that what they see on social media is not real. People present themselves as being perfect and... you know, having all this. And so they believe everyone's beautiful. No one has acne. And, you know, like, it's like most teens have acne, I thought.
It's a carefully curated version of themselves, right?
Yes. And so they believe that these lives, and then they look at themselves and I'm not good enough. I'm not beautiful. No one likes me. I didn't get that many likes. And learning how to not invest so much into what they see on social media, I think, is important. So I think social media has plus and minus, but no one should spend all day on social media. Like, that's not. And as I mentioned before, they cannot, like, watch a lot of violence on social media, things that will sort of distress them. And so how to remove themselves from that. Like, I tell them, don't watch those videos over and over again of violence. So, you know, I understand you have to know about what's going on in the world, but you don't need to kind of keep traumatizing yourself.
Yeah, it's all about the dosage. It's about moderation. Yeah. I want to bring up this comment from Barbara, who says, I'm a retired school psychologist. You keep talking about the gender differences. The fact is that more young males have died by suicide. They are at a higher risk because they seek help less than girls. It's important to talk about how much all kids are struggling, but I want to bring up this research. So important point there, Rhonda. We have talked about teenage girls and how some of these things affect them, but important point about young men.
Yes. So young men are more likely to die by suicide than girls. Girls are more likely to make attempts. And so that's where, so typically when boys, young men make attempts, they're more likely to use more lethal methods, guns. And so they're more likely to die. And so that's the piece that is probably mixed. And I think because we're talking about different groups with attempt and actually death. And yes, boys don't often talk about their feelings. They're not in treatment as much. And so it is a group. And I do think we need to look at suicide prevention by gender and different groups. I think it has to be specific in how we reach out to certain groups, because that is, they're accurate. And then that's the issue of, like, the lethality of the methods that you use.
And what, how do we talk to young men about these issues? Because it seems to me that boys may be less likely to ask for help, to admit that they're struggling. And so how do we reach them and in a preventative way?
I think part of what Emily was talking about before is really getting into environments in which boys are, in a sense, the schools, their primary care environments. But we also need to educate gatekeepers, coaches, people who are in charge of sort of extracurricular activities. There are a bunch of people in the school, the person in the lunchroom, so they can have, because these boys have relationships with other people, community members, and so that we can have access of, they may open up to someone. And so we need to have that person trained to be able to identify it and know what to do. Because I think the only way we're going to be able to address these issues is the whole community coming together.
Yeah. Margaret says, the pandemic unfolded during a political era where racism, intolerance of LGBTQ individuals, and lack of caring about all the inequality of poverty has grown exponentially. And the question is, how can youth thrive when some parents and some government officials can demonstrate intolerance? And so sort of the, I guess, sort of the larger question is that, you know, children are seeing bad behavior in adults, intolerance in adults. How do they thrive in the midst of all of that, Emily?
I think that's a complicated, it's a great question. It's a complicated question, probably with a complicated multifactorial answer. I think one of the main things that we can do is remember that kids are within multiple systems, right? And that's one of the reasons why return to in-person schooling has been so impactful, because it's no longer just the home environment. If the home environment's invalidating, there may be opportunities to interact with supportive teachers. And there is some data that it only really takes one or two supportive people to put a child on a trajectory of resilience and wellness from one of a lot of difficulty and hardship. Obviously, we want them to have more than one, and we want to create a network of support, but really encouraging kindness and teaching people to reach out to someone and find their one support, find their support person, can be just one step among many that can start to chip away at that complicated question.
Yeah. Speaking of chipping away, we want to talk about some solutions, because we've talked about a host of issues that have cropped up during COVID, some very alarming numbers, but we also want to talk about what all of us can do to help mitigate some of this. And Rhonda, I want to begin with you because you are at CHOP. And I'd love for you to talk about what CHOP is doing as an institution to try to address some of these issues with young people and their mental health.
Yes, I mean, part of it is our department and CHOP as a whole have been expanding behavioral health services. In response, it was starting before the pandemic, but it's been increasing. We're actually, we'll be having a new building in which we'll house our outpatient clinic, as well as we'll house a partial program. And we're also will be opening an inpatient program, because we find that oftentimes the kids that we see, when they need more higher levels of care, they had to go outside our system. We also have been expanding our Healthy Minds, Healthy Kids program, in which therapists are embedded in primary care sites. So they see them short term and then they can refer them. But many times it could be resolved during that time. And so we've been also have a relationship with Girard College here in Philadelphia. That is something that's new, in which they receive school mental health consultation. And so we've been working on trying to find sort of effective solutions because we recognize that not everyone may come in the office. So we need different levels of care, but also people within the community also providing services.
And it's interesting that you mentioned the primary care piece of it, because I've been hearing about this one-stop shopping idea that
yes,
more and more healthcare facilities are beginning to integrate behavioral health with physical health.
Yes, and we've already been screening for depression at age, I believe, 12 and higher. And so it likely may be going down. And so that sort of helps identify kids. So we're hoping more screenings will be on the way to sort of identify more of these issues. But the primary care doctors are screening, but then they have someone to refer to within their own practice. So it takes away some of the stigma. Also, if you can just go to your primary care and not have to go to maybe the behavioral health clinic.
Yeah, for sure. Emily, talk about along those same lines, what you are seeing at Penn in terms of, you know, really trying to address this. You talked about, you know, certainly the backlog of cases and the great need. Talk a little bit about what's happening in terms of addressing that need and helping kids move forward from here.
Yeah, I think one of the this isn't necessarily a direct answer to that specific question, but I think one of the things that we need as a field and system to do a better job of is attending to the fractures in our mental health system that shut out a lot of people from accessing affordable services sort of across the board. And so to your original question, yes, Penn is making similar investments to embed like mental health providers in the integrated care settings, not just primary care, but other medical clinics as well. It is really all about access, access, access. But for those individuals who need more long-term outpatient support, it's really, really hard to get somebody in network. And part of that is because of issues with reimbursement from various insurance companies and those reimbursement rates being so low that it's really hard for a provider who's gone to higher level graduate education, maybe carrying their own student debt, to stay within a public system because the reimbursement rates don't allow them to live without taking on second jobs.
Yeah, it's like a disincentive
exactly.
for them almost to do
exactly.
that. And yet the cost of mental health care can be so high, and oftentimes insurance doesn't even cover it. So people who are seeking mental health care for themselves or for their children are forced to pay full freight or go without it,
correct.
It would seem. Right?
Right. It's a major problem. And we really need to see fundamental change at the federal and state level around how we're thinking about reimbursing and structuring mental health payments so that clinicians are incentivized to take insurance and that that reimbursement comes at a rate that supports them to provide high quality, effective and evidence-based care.
And Emily, in the interim, talk to that parent who has a child who may be struggling and has been trying to get help, is trying to figure out how to help that child themselves, is concerned about what the long-term picture is. What can you say to that parent who is listening, who is in exactly that situation and struggling right now?
So first, I would say keep on keeping on. I hear you, and I know that it's hard, and I wish I had a magic wand and could make it easier. I will say the timing is good in that summer tends to be a time where therapy slots open up. And my biggest advice would be do not wait until August when kids start experiencing stress about the upcoming school year to seek care. Seek it in July. Take a preventative approach. Call in June. Call again and again. And again, because August and September tends to be a very peak time of crisis for kids after their summer off. So I would say the timing is ripe, and I would be keep going because you'll probably get in soon would be my first sort of message to all those parents. And the second would be to remember that your job as a parent is not just to fix your kids' problems, and it can be incredibly powerful to validate and hear them in their distress. And rather than rushing in to sort of say, this is what we're going to do, is to just say, that sounds really hard. I hear you. And sit with them in their emotional pain and distress. Because feeling heard, feeling seen, feeling supportive is so powerful.
Yeah. Rhonda, I'd like you to address that as well, just to talk about what we as adults, be it parents, teachers, coaches, medical professionals, ways that we can help. And I think what Emily just said about being able to sort of sit with them in it is so important. But what advice do you have?
I think that's important. One of the things, it's really, really hard for parents to hear their child doesn't want to live. It's heartbreaking. And so parents, as soon as they suspect that there's changes in their child's behavior, their child says something, I believe they should get help. Sometimes we see people come in it's been going on for a couple years, and they're waiting for maybe they think it was a teenage issue
like
that may have been going
through.
A phase that they're going through. They think, oh, it's this circumstance. I think starting early when we think about prevention, because when we see them 2 years after exhibiting depression or anxiety, it's harder to treat. It may be, then we may have to consider medication as well as therapy. So I think as soon as the parents see something that they should actually get help. And I actually think sometimes when they come in, it's like, oh, it is a phase. At least we have it documented.
Yeah. Better to be safe than sorry,
yes.
Right? And start early and be persistent.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Great advice. I want to thank you both so much. We have been talking with Emily Becker-Hames, assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, Dr. Rhonda Boyd, psychologist in the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at CHOP. You've been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. Our producers are Debbie Bilder, Susan Greenbaum, and Paige Murray-Bessler, and our engineer has been Diana Martinez. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.